It is Monday, December 24th, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Katie Henriksen.
Christina Thomas.
Jackie Froelich.
Timothy Dennis.
Antoinette Grajeda.
They say if something happens three times, it's a trend. So apparently it is now a trend for us, a tradition, to spend this week of Christmas talking about our favorite stories from the previous year. This will be the third time we've done this.
Yeah.
Well, the third time most of us have done this. Timothy, this will be the first time you've done it.
Yeah.
Jackie, I want to start with a story that you did this year that had some memories for people because it was about the Wonderland Cave. Tell me about this wonderful place.
Amazing place. You know, as you know, because you've been inside of it, and I want to ask you about that in a second, it was built in the 1930s. It's up in Bella Vista. It's this cave, karst cave, that was transformed into an underground nightclub, and I wished I could have been there in the 1930s to drink and dance. They had a dance floor and a bandstand and all that great stuff. And it served as a nightclub venue over the decades and then started to fade. But you drank inside there.
Late 1980s. I don't think it was open much longer after I went there, but several of us went and were underwhelmed, to be honest, at the time. It was kind of a sad state.
That's right, because it's real damp in that cave and things were starting to rot. So the thing is, vandals took it over after it was abandoned, and it was so thrashed. There was tons of garbage inside, and through default, this woman from California by the name of Jan Edwards ended up owning this parcel because she had helped an investor who defaulted on his loan. And so she and her partner took over the dream of restoring this remarkable relic. And so I was invited to attend along with a group of high school science students. It was so fun. And officials with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We went into the cave. The kids were hauling out debris. I was trying to tape as many people as possible. But I have an update before the story airs.
Okay.
And the update, I just spoke with Mary this morning, one of the partners, and she says that not only have they completely cleaned out the cave and are looking to restore it, they've cleaned the 30 acres all around it. They're looking to partner up with investors and to reopen Wonderland Cave. We just don't know when, but the hope lives on.
And here is the story. Here's the story as it aired this summer, right?
Yeah. The entrance to Wonderland Cave's barely visible off winding Dartmoor Road in eastern Bella Vista this morning. Because like the fabled secret garden, after years of neglect, the forest has consumed it. But unlike many wild Ozarks caves, where you have to climb or crawl to get inside, a concrete stairway takes you down onto a winding paved walkway through a series of immense caverns. State wildlife agents, cavers, the new owners, invited media, and a select group of teenagers, all wearing caving gear and headlamps, gather around an underground spring pool for orientation. Bats, disturbed by all this strange vibration, swoop by, illuminated by the 50 or so headlamps. Ronald Redman, a state-sanctioned bat expert, has grabbed one of the bats from its upside-down perch on the cave's sparkling ceiling. It's a small tri-colored bat, and it's not happy.
He's biting it.
He can't get a good bite on me. It's hard for him to break the skin. Plus, I've had rabies shots, so I'm not too worried about it. He's not even breaking it, so yeah, he's just a little mad.
You would be, too, if your home had been utterly thrashed. Over the past 20 or so years, Wonderland Cave was vacant, and vandals completely destroyed it, ripping out all the electricity, plumbing, and fixtures, leaving behind garbage. But today is the first day of Wonderland Cave's recovery. 35 Rogers High School outdoor science students are here, both to learn about cave ecology and to clean the old jazz joint up, dressed in protective white coveralls, heavy gloves, helmets, and armed with garbage bags.
Hey, groups of five, Rogers, folks. Groups of five, okay?
Students divide up into teams and disappear into the darkness. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service secured special federal grant funding for this project. Within an hour, the teenagers' trash bags are bulging with debris.
Katie Hanks, we found a bunch of beer cans. I found a cassette player, There were some pantyhose down there.
In the first cavern, the walkway circles up and through a low passage into a second cavern, the Grand Ballroom, that used to have a big bandstand and wooden dance floor. But with 100% humidity, it's all rotted away. Back when Wonderland was being built, however, masons drilled a bore through which they could deliver mixed concrete into troughs inside to build benches, low walls, and booths, and pave all the walkways. Those are intact, but everything's marked with gang graffiti. After it first opened in the 1930s as an underground nightclub, it remained accessible to the public as an entertainment venue on and off for decades until the early 1990s. The site also served as a civil defense nuclear fallout shelter. California native Jan Edwards took ownership of Wonderland Cave 12 years ago after a previous businessman in whom she had invested tried but failed to develop it. She and her partner, Mary Miller, are here as well today. They shine their helmet lights onto an old VIP seating area and talk about their vision for Wonderland.
We're standing inside the cave and amongst the rock formation, and you notice there are no lights. Well, it used to be a lighted cave, but we've had some vandalism through the years, and we are going to put back railing lights along the trails, and they're LED, and they go down, tube lighting all the way around with the railings, restore the cave and add to it maybe a restaurant recreation area and make it a wonderful family experience and adventure for the people of Bella Vista.
Above ground on the 30-acre property, the women plan a water feature, petting zoo, indoor-outdoor restaurant, a picnic area, and a miniature golf course. Mary Miller, an East Coast native, has a big background in retail sales and marketing, and she's begun to rebrand the 30-acre Wonderland Cave estate as a family vacation destination. And it turns out Jan Edwards has family roots in Western Arkansas, so is really excited about this project.
I have always been an investor. I come from a real estate family, and this came up as an opportunity for an investment with a group of people, and it just sounded interesting, and I went for it.
What tipped their decision to go for it was the opening of Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. Both women look to draw museum patrons to Wonderland Cave. Total renovation and construction costs are estimated to be around $2 million. Financing has not yet been secured, but the women are confident the project will proceed to completion later in 2013.
We hope to be open and have a very grand reopening, but we will be open in phases. For instance, we hope to get the cave open first, and we'll be building in the background the other pieces. And we're so excited we can hardly stand ourselves. We're just dying to do this. And this experience today with all of the people who are helping us, the fish, game and wildlife people stepping up to the plate to help us to be sure that we don't have any issues, environmental issues. I mean, it's just incredible for us.
Standing nearby listening to the conversation is Bentonville native Betty Rendon, who at age 82 remembers drinking cocktails and dancing in Wonderland Cave's ballroom.
And I have pictures of my husband and I and friends sitting in booths over there.
What was the drink that you were drinking?
You know, I think we all drank bourbon and Coke. Can you imagine that? I couldn't drink that now if somebody held a gun to my head.
And did you dance?
Oh, absolutely. Wonderful bands. Big bands, yeah, wonderful. Oh, yeah, it was just great.
5 decades later, Betty is back, this time not in high heels, but dressed in white coveralls and a hard hat. As she and other team members exit the cave into the steamy sunshine, they scrub their boots, dip them in bleach, and peel off their gloves and muddy white coveralls for disposal. Helmets and lights and other tools are also disinfected. The decontamination protocol is necessary due to an infectious disease called white nose syndrome, which is decimating large populations of cave-dwelling bats in more than a dozen states. Aaron Leone is an endangered species biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Conway, who is presenting a program to volunteers inside the cave.
And it's a deadly fungus that's killing millions of bats. Our count is up to around 7 million bats right now. It has not yet been detected in Arkansas, so we are doing everything we can to prevent and possibly slow the spread of the fungus. We know that bats can transmit it from bat to bat and cave to cave, so we are pretty sure we can also spread it on our clothes and on our shoes. So we suit up to prevent carrying it. All of our suits will be thrown away, and whatever is exposed, we will go through a rigorous decontamination procedure.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agents have been monitoring bat hibernacula, where bats hibernate, in advance of the disease's arrival in Arkansas to protect endangered gray bat colonies, some of which historically reside in Wonderland, as well as Indiana bats and the Ozark big-eared bat, which number only around 1,500 individuals. Ronald Redmond, a Wetland and Stream Mitigation Program coordinator, the Arkansas Natural Resources Commission, is a top bat expert in Arkansas who monitors for the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. He says bats are critical to our agricultural economy and overall health.
Each square foot of like little brown bats will eat about a ton to 2 tons of mosquito-sized insects a year. And I've seen some numbers that they're estimating that if we lose the insect control populations the bats provide in Arkansas, because they're all insectivorous bats, it's in the trillions. So they're quiet, they kind of keep to themselves, but they're an extremely important critter.
Tommy Enebnit, a biologist with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, coordinated the Wonderland Cave Cleanup Day expedition, including securing the Boston Mountain Grotto Club to help protect and guide students inside the cave complex.
It's also a great example that we want to set for these kids, showing them, look what's being done. Look at all this graffiti. Look at all this trash. You know, please don't do this, and hopefully teach them the right way of going into a cave and doing it responsibly.
Standing in the cave's vestibule, local caving expert Larry Mortz looked pleased. He knows firsthand how badly the cave needed attention. He's dedicated the past decade to mapping Wonderland Cave.
It takes quite a few hours to map the cave system. We've got over a mile of passage in here, which is pretty extensive for a cave system in northwest Arkansas. And we've discovered quite a few undiscovered passages in here back in 2000, and opened up quite a bit of the cave, and most of the pretty stuff is in the back where you can't find it.
Some estimate the cave to be more than 1 million square feet, comprised of two levels and an underground stream bed. But Larry Mortz has found so much more. And above ground historical remnants still stand as well. Bella Vista Historical Museum docent Zita Lucas walks up a set of stone steps to the old caretaker's cottage, recently torched by vandals.
When it was being used.
Look at that stone fireplace. The rock facade still stands.
Yes, this was the where the couple lived that took care of the cave. Wonderland Cave is most known for the fact that it was an underground nightclub. The Linebargers went to Paris on vacation and went to a cave in Paris that was a nightclub. And they said, we've got this big cave sitting in Bella Vista. We could make this into a nightclub. So they came back and did that, opened it up in early 1930. So it was open for several decades. And the rumor was that they had big bands here. They did not have big bands here, like nationally known bands, but they had a lot of bands here that played big band music. And a lot of people over the years enjoyed dancing and parties. We've got pictures at the museum of weddings that were conducted here. So it was really a big entertainment feature for Northwest Arkansas. And as part of the old Bella Vista vacation resort, it was a big attraction.
By the end of the day, the science students and volunteers had hauled out enough trash to overfill a 20-yard-long dumpster, recovering 15 large trash bags of recyclables and the spirit of historic Wonderland Cave. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
We're not a show that talks to a lot of famous people, but people do come through occasionally. This year, Martin Short was at Walton Arts Center, and I had a brief conversation. We're not going to play it all. Let me ask you guys this. Do you ever find sometimes when you're talking to someone who has done a lot of interviews, sometimes the interviews, they're not being rude, but they're rote. They've done
they're
so
canned.
Many.
There's,
yeah.
And you can't blame them.
And
if
they hear the same questions, so they give the same answers.
Exactly. Martin Short was not rote. And this was an early morning. It was like a 7:30 a.m. phone call. But he was hilarious. And at one point I asked him about the character Jiminy Glick, mm-hmm. you know, that he created.
Yeah.
And this is what he had to say. so many of your familiar characters, like Jiminy Glick and Ed Grimley, have this sort of charming, unaware quality. There is an innocence with them, especially with Ed Grimley. Even with Jiminy Glick, he doesn't really realize what kind of uninformed buffoon he can be, does he?
No, he's just a moron with power. So he would say to, if I did this interview with Mel Brooks once where I said to him, "What's your big beef with the Nazis?" And he just looked at me and said, "Oh, I don't know. I think they're rude," you know. But it's not that Jiminy Glick is trying to. He thinks he's Oprah.
Right.
He's just Oprah without a brain.
And of course, the series was on Comedy Central, and I know that you would bring people up when you had the run, the permanent run on stage. Is there any preparation for the guest? Does Mel Brooks or Jerry Seinfeld or anybody like that have?
I would usually, you know, half hour before the show, while I'm getting made up or something, I would go to IMDb and I would quickly refresh myself with the history, because you didn't have to know a lot because Jiminy Glick was so ill informed. Usually I would go to the most obscure credit and then be the biggest fan of that. So that the person struggling to even know what you're talking about when you're going on about his role as Dr. Jackson in, you know, The Guiding Light.
Your first acting job really was in Godspell, is that correct?
Yes, in Toronto.
With an amazing cast.
I was still in university, but I auditioned for it. And, it was Gilda Radner, and Paul Schaefer was at University of Toronto, and they hired him, and Eugene Levy, and Andrea Martin, and Victor Garber. Was Jesus. It was that thing where you suddenly realize years later, wow, that was an unusual period of time, which it was in Toronto. John Candy was trying to get a job. Danny Aykroyd always smelled of gas because he was always working on his car. He was trying to get a job.
Okay. Is there any living person that you would just really like to interview? that if I said we have an unlimited amount.
I think you asked that last year, and I'm pretty sure I said you, because you've done so many interviews, and I still haven't done that interview, so I guess I could reuse that answer.
I think we said we would wait for the 25th anniversary.
Is that what we said?
I don't think that's what we said.
Well. I think that's what you just now said.
Well, I interviewed Rick
Stockdale, that's right.
Our station
really
manager,
good.
So that's sort of close to interviewing Kyle.
That is close.
I mean, you know.
It's close.
Yeah.
Well, I think you're right. I think I did ask that question last year, but Timothy mm-hmm. Dennis didn't have a chance to answer that.
Here.
He was not on our staff, so... Is there someone you would like to interview?
You know, just my knee-jerk reaction would be Willie Nelson, just to see what that guy has seen, you know?
You know
what
he's felt. You know who's interviewed Willie Nelson?
I'm guessing Jacqueline Frohlich.
Mm-hmm. On his bus.
Wow.
Done.
And it was a little smoky in there.
Oh, I'm sure it was.
Katie, you and Antoinette were both in here when mm-hmm. Time for Three.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Katie had set it up, and I was helping her set up the equipment and somehow wound up helping with the interview. Yeah. I wasn't expecting that. So that was fun, thinking on my feet. But Katie, you knew of them before they came to the Walton Arts Center, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I knew they're coming through, and it's they're an exciting ensemble because they combine all different types of music. I mean, they're mm-hmm. a classically trained trio. They went to the Curtis Institute, and mm-hmm. but they rearrange sometimes pop songs.
Right.
So, and then they do original songs as well.
Right. So. I think what was so interesting for me about this particular interview is it was a great interview. The guys were a lot of fun to talk to, but they performed for us. And like Katie said, it's like your own private concert, but I knew nothing about these guys. And Ithi Agnihotri Madolka was in here with mm-hmm. us too, getting some video. And like when they were done playing, we were immediately like, we have to go to the show. Like we had no intention. We're like, oh, we'd heard they were coming, had no idea who they were, whatever. But after playing, we're like, no, we have to go.
Very charismatic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much. So we were quite pleased. That was interesting from that perspective because oftentimes I hear, you know, we've put something on the air that people sparked interest for other people to go and check out. So it's kind of fun to be one of those people that, you know, our interest was sparked, and so we went and got to enjoy the concert at the Walton Arts Center.
Well, let's hear some of the performance from when they were right here where we are now, the Furman Garner Performance Studio. This is Time for Three, and they were performing like the day of, mm-hmm. later that night, they were going to be at Walton Arts Center.
Right after they did the performance here, they went to a school because they also did
right.
outreach with the schools, uh-huh. and so they went straight to a school right after that, and then they played.
In the evening they played at yeah. the Walton Arts Center, yeah.
Yeah.
So you guys are going to play something for us. Can you tell me a little bit about what you're going to play?
We're going to play a piece called Hide and Seek by Imogen Heap, and that we arranged with Steve Hackman, Time for Three. Hide and Seek is a piece, you know, by Imogen Heap, of course, but that Nick actually heard for the first time through the movie The Last Kiss, Zach Graff movie. Mm-hmm. It's just a beautiful piece. I think what Nick noticed about it, well, gosh, I mean, Nick's right here. Maybe you should talk about it.
It was, like Renan's saying, I mean, it's like when I was in the theater with my friends, I was really enjoying the movie. And I'm a big fan of Zach Braff. And I, when Hide and Seek came on, she and her producer uses her voice and layers it on top of each other and creates a very homogeneous, very thick sounding, thick sound. Mm-hmm. And it just reminded me of a chamber piece, like a quartet piece. If you look at a score, the way it was crafted and the way she wrote the song, it just felt like chamber music. And especially with the kind of sound that we produce, I thought that it would be really interesting for us to kind of undertake that as a project. So we did that with Steve Hackman, and this is what it sounds like.
Time for Three, recorded inside the Furman Garner.
And then not long after that, they were at Carnegie Hall playing.
That's right. And when it's kind of amazing when you see some of the people that come through this area, like the Tokyo String Quartet came to Walton Arts Center a couple of months ago. Their last tour. They're packing in after this tour. It was Fayetteville, then to Tulsa, and then I think maybe to, you know, Albuquerque. And after that, they had Lisbon, London, and Tokyo. And they were here. We're fortunate in that, I think.
Yes, for sure.
Here's a secret. The way we put these shows together, about 2 weeks out, I ask everyone, come up with a list of some of your favorite stories, and then we kind of hone it down from there, because we can't play them all. Most people have a list and say, pick from this. Christina Thomas has a list. And then a couple days later, she has a different list. And then just hours before we come into the studio, there's a different list.
And she has a huge stack of papers in front of her.
I'm relatively indecisive.
Relatively?
Yes.
Well, that's great.
One of the stories that you, at the last moment, almost at the last moment, you said, no, wait, Prairie.
Well, Tim and I were talking about it and decided that, you know, it was a good sound story. And, you know, and I have a memory from that actually also, which I'll say in a minute. But it's a good sound story because it's a group of a bunch of retired guys, actually, that want to restore this patch of land by Lake Fayetteville. You know, cedar trees and other invasive plants have overtaken it, and they want to restore it back to what it, you know, a prairie, what it was, you know, 150, 200 years ago. And so I went and visited these guys as they were chopping down cedar trees. And my memory from that is I got covered in chiggers.
Ugh.
And had chigger bites for probably 2 weeks after that experience.
You know,
that
I'm
excursion.
Amazed how few people actually know about chiggers, because I grew up here where you get chiggers if you sit in the grass, but mm-hmm. people who didn't grow up where they uh-huh. they could grow up in places where they could sit in the grass and not get chiggers.
Oh, what a wonderful place it would be to live in a place where you didn't have to think about chiggers. Anyway, we're getting off topic. Let's hear this prairie story.
Okay.
Where you got the chiggers?
Yes.
If you walk the trail at Lake Fayetteville on a cloudy morning late last month, maybe you heard the sounds of a chainsaw through the trees and brush. But good luck finding the source. About six or so volunteers have been asked by the park officials to leave no evidence of their entrance into the woods. David Chapman, one of the guys wielding a chainsaw, explains what the group is out here doing.
Well, I'm doing conservation work, I suppose, is the way to describe it. You know, we're trying to restore this in old prairie, which it used to be. And there's a lot of work needs to be done, cutting down invasive timbers and clearing and all this sort of thing. So we've been working on it for 3 or 4 years now.
The we Chapman is referring to is the Fayetteville Natural Heritage Association, or FNHA, a nonprofit whose mission is to identify and protect Fayetteville's most important natural areas, as well as the community's tree canopy. Places like the Mount Sequoia Woods and this land, located inside a portion of the circular trail at Lake Fayetteville. This area was identified as upland prairie during the group's green infrastructure planning. One of FNHA's board members got together with the superintendent for the City of Fayetteville's Parks and Recreation Department to develop a plan to restore between 30 and 40 acres to natural prairie habitat. But what is a prairie?
Oh, well, it's grassland. It's ancient grassland. Not what we see when we drive around, I'm afraid. You know, these are the original prairie with lots of characteristic plants associated with it, and there's remnants of it here, and that's why this work's being done here. But in northwest Arkansas, there are very few places where you've got genuine prairie still left. Most of them have been plowed or reseeded or treated with herbicides and this kind of thing, you know. So it's a fairly unique place here, especially being within the bounds of the city of Fayetteville and also close to Springdale. So
the group is out here chopping down cedar trees and black cherry trees, clearing the way for the city to use herbicides on one of the most invasive grasses, Lespedisa sericea, which looks like something a farmer might chew on. The city also uses controlled burns, they've had three so far, to clear the way for the native plants to resurface. Bob Koch, chairman of FNHA, says lack of fire is one of the major causes for the disappearing prairie.
This is what naturally happens when you don't have fire. You know, in the olden days, this area would burn every couple years, and that would restore the prairie and keep the invasives out. But when man came in here, he made sure that fire didn't happen. And so the invasives, like the cedar trees, started taking over. And we have aerial photographs from like 1940 on, showing that like in 1940 there weren't many cedar trees out here at all. But by 1999, the place was just covered with them.
Dwayne Walchin, FNH member and Workday organizer, points out some of the native prairie plants.
This one is Indian grass, and that's a native grass. And this one is switchgrass, which is also a native grass. And that's my two native grasses. And you see goldenrod, the plants that are beginning to show a little yellow in places and a lot in other places. And as we walk around through the seasons out here, we see all kinds of small patches of plants that are native. And by improving the habitat out here, those plants will spread from those vestige populations to become much more dominant. And
they have already been successful on one patch of land. Part of the hope is that as the native plants return, so will the animals. David Chapman, a poultry scientist by day, says you'll get prairie types of birds, meadowlarks, bobolinks, and certain sparrows.
I'm not an expert on anything else. I did see two very large rat snakes yesterday, and I actually even flushed a pair of horned owls from this grove of trees here. So it's the sort of place where horned owls would nest.
Dwayne Walchin says a lot of the animals that will return will be rodents, mice, and ground-burrowing animals. He also comments on what you won't see.
I was stopped one day by a couple of young ladies who were on the paved trail as we were coming out of the woods, and she was asking me what we were doing. I told her about it, and she says, "Oh, will buffalo be back?" I said, "No, I'm sorry. I don't think buffalo will be back." But that's the type of animal that would have been here. And also, there were eastern elk, which were habitants of this area. And We don't expect to see those either, but quail, and particularly the birds, are going to enjoy a major comeback because of this diversity that they've got here now.
Bob Cox says that this is a project that will never be finished. They must maintain the prairie year after year. He does hope that within a couple of years, the city's environmental center, which is located nearby, can begin to bring students here.
To show them how the areas like this go into succession, going from prairies to savannas, then into the thick forest as you move back in. And so this has been developed with input from them so that they can use this as part of their educational program.
Also part of this plan is to work with the city to develop signs to place along the trails. Signs teaching of the natural history of this area, this particular restoration process, as well as the people history of this property. Last month, in order to foster enthusiasm and support, this project got a name, Callie's Prairie.
Mrs. Henson, Sarah Catherine Callie Greg Henson.
Callie grew up in the area, though her family fled during the Civil War.
When she came back to the area, is reputed to have said when she came back through this area that, "I love this area, I want to live here." And so 6 years later, Her family, or her husband, bought the land and they moved here and lived here. And actually, the family continued to own land in this area until about 1941?
1948.
Just before the city bought the property to build the lake.
He says that whether or not she really said that, it sure sounds romantic. Also romantic is the success of Lake Fayetteville Park and Callie's Prairie. David Chapman confirms.
And I mean, this has been an unbelievably successful project here, because when they open the hardtop trail, I mean, hundreds of people use it. And so I talk about it as being the jewel of the park system. And, you know, there's a fine balance between giving the public what they want, you know, so they can walking around and everything like that, and also saving the natural habitat that's here.
This is a sort of year-end tradition with us at Ozarks Large, where we talk about some of our favorite stories, hear parts of favorite of our stories that we worked on. Katie, I also want to ask you about one about music therapy that you did this year.
Yes. There was a music therapist who came through to give a lecture. She's based in Austin, and she was giving a lecture at the university. But the topic, I mean, of music therapy was very personal to me. My mom is a musician and wants to do more music therapy, so I guess I really connected with her whenever it was. Her name's Hope Young, and she just had a lot to. We had a really. It's amazing when you get on. Like, it was via phone because I wanted to have a story ready for the air before she was giving her lecture.
To let people know she was coming.
Yeah, and so we were talking on the phone, but we ended up having just an amazing conversation, and that's what I like when I do interviews. I have some thought out questions, but then I kind of just let it take a conversation, and sometimes it can turn into something really amazing.
Well, my mom was a special educator and a musician. Now, I would say out of the two of us, my mom is par excellence, the amazing musician compared to me. She was a colored soprano, amazing composer, pianist. She got her degree in music at UMKC, University of Missouri, Kansas City. But then she did her master's and PhD in special ed and deaf ed. So when I was born, mom was doing deaf ed at the Kansas State School for the Deaf, and I'd go and sign with her. So my whole growing up, I was around people with special needs. And so I was very naturally drawn to that, to working with special needs folks, to working with older adults. My mom became mentally ill. As got older, so I was very drawn to the mental illness and understanding it from a very personal side, the challenges of understanding, living with, treating mental illnesses from the early career, special education, from my own needs of dealing with so much diversity, my own tendency to turn towards music as my anchor, my light, my healing, my main drug of choice, I guess. I never got into drugs. I never did that. But I know that there's something you turn to anchor instead. It was music from a very early age. Music became, you know, what brought light and hope and kept me. But I just started doing it. And I think it's sometimes some of us just find a career that we get paid for being who we are. And I think my natural talents, my love for people is first. My second is music. I don't come to the music and love the music so much as I love the music and its power with people. So I do love the music, but when you take it out of context of the person, for me, and I lose my taproot, I lose my anchor. I don't want to be on that stage performing to make $1 million to be a superstar. I want the music to heal, to treat, to get somebody walking again, to hear their voice for the first time, to get turned on, to not only, you know, sing, speak, communicate, love, live. And that's what music can do when brought into this. But mainly in music, we're so pushed towards stage, we're so pushed towards education, we're so pushed if you've got talent, because I did have talent. I wouldn't say I lack it, but I just always felt like a peon compared to my mother. With her gifts, but it doesn't have the same meaning as it does when you're, you know, if it's the hospice situation and dealing with the pain and how music can express those things that you just can't find words for as you're, you know, looking at the end of your life and reaching out in those last moments towards your family and your kids and, you know, your husband. that's where I want to be. That's always where I wanted to be. That's where I stay. That's why I created the center.
And
really,
what is there? Can you verbalize what makes music unique in that way, and engaging with people and helping people out?
It's a phenomena, really. And I guess that's what I love about it. It's the only thing we have in the human experience that can do all these things, that encapsulates the whole human experience in a very pragmatic way. I can tell you that neurologically it's a phenomenon. It is the only stimulus, the sensory, like senses, you know, sight, sound, touch, taste, hearing. It's the only one that can activate all the areas of the brain at once. And so the brain, you kind of look at it as the center of where everything in the human experience gets processed. Everything experience goes right through that brain. Well, at one time, you can be touching that very deep spiritual experience that we have such a hard time giving words to, but that music can express when we, you know, reach out and love and share intimacy, when we feel betrayal and then we go through redemption, when we go through our deepest grief and loss. Those things that music can give voice to, nothing else, as well as some very functional stuff. I can do that at the same time I'm asking a person, after they've just, you know, lost functioning in their brain, to get up and believe again in me. And I can touch that spirit that needs to be touched and say, stand and walk. Dare to believe me right now and have some hope and get up and try to stand, even though you're going to feel like you're going to fall and you think you're never going to walk again. And I can put very functional pragmatics into that and get them walking again, get their bodies synchronized into a simple beat and rhythm, and help their spirit every day get up and try again, don't give up. And there's just nothing else that we have that's not a medicine, that's not a surgery, that's, you know, not invasive, that you can get in there and help lift and touch that spirit. And if it wants to breathe in a shot again of faith and hope and love and just give life a shot again, and then very functionally help them walk again, help them talk again. A child who thinks, you know, who's having a hard time developing, have patience and keep trying harder to develop. You know, roll over. These little babies, just with music, keep pushing, roll over. Little babies have strokes in the womb and stuff, and they have a really tough time. There's just nothing like it. There's not many modalities or treatments or things in the world that we have that you can touch that all at one moment and use it to really impact the human life and make it better.
As Young explains, music therapy begins with assessment, figuring out what the person's needs are and what musical tastes they have.
In that first session, it's all about assessment, finding out about the person, what stage, what's their diagnosis, then finding the right fit. As they actually start, then let's just take an example. Say it's the walking, that they really have a tough time walking. Their feet stick to the floor. They take short little strides. We get them assessed with music, finding out, we measure how many steps they take per minute. We find out what kind of music they like, if it's country, if it's R&B, if it's like classical, like a John Philip Sousa. As soon as I find how many steps per minute they're taking, I match that style exactly to the beat they're walking at and start getting them just to train the feet to move to that rhythm at that tempo, relax into it, and then I start to incrementally usually speed them up, because foot movement's usually the problem. So speed them up 5%, 10% increments to get them to take bigger steps, to get them to move faster, get them arm swings going. So in the very first session, we're finding out what kind of music motivates them, but also that would go with just a walking 1-2, 1-2, da 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 da, if they like classical.
And before we end this edition, occasionally I get excited about a story I'm doing or someone I'm interviewing.
Occasionally?
Do you really want to say that, Kyle, on the record?
I think we need to
Okay, so one of the jokes is I tend to get excited about almost anything.
Yes.
Which
it's
can
not
be a plus.
A joke, it's a fact.
Which can be a plus or a minus, I understand. But one fact that I discovered this year, I interviewed Ben Bolden about his book, Hidden Fort Smith History. Mm-hmm. Ben now lives in Little Rock, but he for years had a column in the Southwest Times Record. And it turns out that perhaps the first woman to ever vote in the United States did so in Fort Smith.
All right.
And so I want to just play part of that conversation because there should be a huge monument if this is true. And it certainly she was one of the first because it was a special election. Anyway, I'll let him send it up. This is Ben Bolden talking about part of his book, Hidden Fort Smith History. Well, finally, I want to ask you about a person who I'd never heard of before I picked this book up, and it's a shame that I hadn't and that more people haven't, and that's Dimple Johnson. She owns quite a historic milestone, doesn't she?
Yeah, and I keep meaning to, and I will dig more into her personal story, but yeah, she was the first dental hygienist in Fort Smith, and even more significantly, discovered recently, you could call her the first Southern woman to vote in a public election in America.
And she did that in 1917.
Yeah, it was before the passage of the constitutional amendment that gave women the right to vote, which was a couple years later. But she, what happened is in early 1917, I believe February, the state legislature passed a law allowing women to vote in party primaries. And because they could do that by statute, they didn't have to amend the Constitution to do that. So it was a lot easier, the process. So they said, well, let's go ahead and do that. At least we can get that out of the way. And so they did, but the first statewide primaries weren't scheduled until, I think, May 1918. They had a very different electoral schedule then. And what happened is people have to read the book because it's a lot, very complicated story you probably don't have time for. But the short of it is there was a mayoral, special mayoral election called. And under the law, or due to some technicalities, it was considered a primary. So women were allowed to vote in the primary. And Dimple Johnson cast her vote, the first vote in a southern state by a woman in a public election, as far as I can determine, because Arkansas was the first southern state to allow women to vote in any election, I believe, at 8 a.m. November 13th, 1917. And I think I know where.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the building's still there. It's an office near the corner of North 6th. And A Street, and it was a fire station back then, which makes sense. It would be a city fire station. It's a city election, so it, would have made sense to use that as a polling place. But and the reason it came up is there was another woman who was a school teacher who started. She had been the first woman voter, and so the Southwest American, which Dimple Johnson worked for, by that point, sent a reporter down to look at the poll books and determine that the other woman, the school teacher, had voted at a polling place that opened just a few minutes late on that morning. And then Dimple Johnson's had opened on time, and so they considered her to be the first voter. And, I would think that would warrant a plaque at least.
At the very least.
Yeah. So, and that was a fairly recent discovery, and for me personally, that was the most interesting part of the book.
And that's Ben Bolden when he was talking about his book, Hidden History of Fort Smith. This is Ozarks at Large. Tomorrow, we'll have more of our favorite stories. But before we get to tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large, and we'll have our favorite stories the rest of the week, something new because this is our last chance before New Year's Eve to have Becca Martin Brown in the studio. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And Becca is with us to kind of get us geared up for New Year's Eve next Monday.
How can it be the end of the year? This is what Antoinette and I always do, and this is the worst.
Mm-hmm.
This is the worst.
Mm-hmm.
I just learned to write 2012.
Right? Ugh.
But, although it's been a somewhat challenging year, we're going to move on to 2013 and see if it gets better.
And we have ways to get there.
We do. Last Night Fayetteville, which is much like First Night Fayetteville used to be, but different organizers, not affiliated with the First Night series around the world.
Right.
This is the second year for Last Night, and it is bigger and better, with a main stage that has Three Penny Acre, Groovement, and Randall Shreve in the sideshow headlining. Seven indoor venues around the square with musicians and performers and comedians and artists. They've added a full children's stage. They've added a jazz stage. Pretty much if you want it, they've got it, including the Flying Hog Drop at midnight and fireworks.
Yes.
I love fireworks. And a beer garden with locally brewed beer and a burlesque show.
Right. And all three of those are run by different people. So the beer and the fireworks and the burlesque are all separate.
You think?
Yes.
It works out better that way.
Yes, it does.
And they've got another one of Erica Wilhite's Sheet Fort theater performances. A love letter to Fayetteville, she calls it. And, of course, the giant puppet parade. Admission is $10.
But anything happening outside is free.
Right.
So the puppet parade is absolutely free.
But and the fireworks are free.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it's $10 for the inside venues, $5 for children, and there are some VIP tickets for $50 that include access to the BHK VIP lounge, which will have live jazz, catered hors d'oeuvres, desserts, a champagne bar. Sounds good to me.
Yes.
And you can find out more at lastnightfayetteville.com. John Two Hawks is in concert on New Year's Eve at 7 o'clock at the Victory Theater in Rogers. We went last year, and it was a lovely way to kick off the new year.
I bet.
Absolutely beautiful. Tickets are $12 for the balcony or $20 for downstairs seating, which comes with snacks. And you can get tickets at 888-790-9091. Now, we'll have all this in What's Up on Friday, too. Okay. After you've stuffed yourself and opened presents and all of that. There's a New Year's Eve bash with Ultra Suede. Crazy people that they are. At the Holiday Inn in Springdale, tickets are $38 a couple.
And I believe 2013 is the 20th anniversary of Ultra Suede.
Really?
I believe it is.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's a Mayor's Countdown to 2013 at the Fort Smith Convention Center. It's a family fun night. Starts at 8 o'clock. There's a dance party and bouncy games and video games. And you pay by buying tickets like a carnival.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds fun.
788-8932. And there's a sock hop at Mulligan's at the Highlands in Bella Vista. Dinner from 5 to 8, entertainment from 7 to midnight, and, of course, in poodle skirts and saddle Oxfords. And that's $17 per person, and I believe, I know it includes dinner, and I believe it's prime rib.
Not bad.
855-8114. And the next time I talk to you, it'll be 2013, so Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year.
And since this is actually Christmas Eve, again, Merry Christmas to you.
Everybody, thank you for everything this year. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad. Feliz Navidad.